Maybe it's the big time at last.
Big time. Hey? Big time. You're getting paid the big bucks now.
Yeah, yeah. I got plonked on a desk with a phone in front of me, a Rolodex of numbers, sink or swim, and I just went the opposite way on it and sort of downplayed my success and downplayed, made myself out to be the worst boss in the world and was starving, hungry, and had to sell my children. And I think I've got 52,000 followers or something like that. I could walk out in front of a football stadium every single day and say, buy my stuff. When I put this stuff on out there on LinkedIn, going, guess how much this stuff costs? Guess how much your top-end Monaco, like private jet, super yacht, five-star hotel, helicopters, all the rest of it. And it might be that it's some ridiculous figure, like 100 grand for four people or something like that. Is it ethically, morally right to spend £10,000 on a watch? Probably not.
James Clarbuck, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Great to have last. You. You're finally here.
Made it to the big time at last.
Big time. Hey? Big time. You're getting paid the big bucks now.
Yeah, yeah.
Big open question to kick off, James. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
It depends who you ask about the problem side of things, but I run a company called Barclay Red. We're a VIP events and hospitality company. We do everything from, you know, the high-end Monaco Grand Prix, that sort of thing, British Grand Prix, through to Royal Ascots and corporate events on yachts and all the rest of it. So we've got a really wide-ranging company. We do incentive trips and big events for major corporates all the way through to Mr. and Mrs. Smith who want to go to their first Grand Prix with their kids. So we've got a really wide-ranging company. We've been going for about sort of 7 years now, and that's really my background is corporate events. And I've been in it since I grew up at about age 26, having failed at a professional cricket career. I thought I needed to get in the real world and to have a proper job. Saw an advert in the back of the paper. Do you want to be in sport? Yes, I do. And it turned out it was a telesales job. Had nothing to do with sport whatsoever. It was just selling stuff at sporting events. But that was an eye-opener in terms of the world of sales and business, and that was where I started, sort of age 26, with a list of phone numbers and a telephone and sell that, hard telesales, and then progressed through a number of companies from there to being approached by some clients of mine about 20 years ago, I guess it would be now, to start a company with them. And that was my previous agency, does very much what we do now. And I was with them for about 15 years, built it into a big multi-million pound company, agency, ran its course. We went our separate ways and Barclay Red started about 7 years ago with one of my best mates from university, basically. So that's it in a nutshell.
In a nutshell.
And the problem is, you always get the sort of sales advice going, what problem do you solve? And I never kind of related that to what we do, because it's not a problem. If you can't go to the Monaco Grand Prix on a super yacht, it's not a problem in your life. It's more a need and a want. So it's kind of what want do we solve, as opposed to what problem? Make dreams come true, that sort of thing. I guess if you were to relate it to a company, it would be, you know, our problem is we want to have we don't have a very good relationship with our clients. We want to have a deeper relationship with our clients, and what we do enables them to do that in a sense. So if you want to relate it to a problem, that would be it. But it's more a business improvement thing or a need or a bucket list thing, that sort of side of things. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, there's loads of ways I could unpack that. It feels like the way you were describing it, it's a bit like a vitamin, like, you know, that or maybe something else a little bit spicier, that if you take it, you know, you're gonna have a good time.
Yeah.
I guess let's just rewind, so go back to you walking into that first telesales job. What were your expectations, and what was the actual realization? What did that actually look like?
I've been through university, and anyone who's been to university will tell you, back in when I went, it was a good time. You know, it was more of a social aspect to it than anything else. So the work side, I'd never really worked that hard academically. It was mainly there for the for the drinks and the girls and the sport and all the rest of it. So I had a very, very social time at university, and I thought, yeah, this is 4 years of life. At the same time, I said I was trying to play professional cricket at the time, which carried on for another sort of 2 or 3 years after that. So I was kind of having this sort of dilettante lifestyle of having enough money to buy enough beers. I wasn't earning a lot by any stretch, but I had enough money to keep a roof over my head and have enough beers with my mates. And it was almost like life is going to carry on like this forever. And at some point that stopped. It was, no, this is no longer available. This money is no longer available for you. A lot of my mates were, at the time, 26, 27, moving up the corporate ladder a little bit. They'd already had 5 years in corporate jobs, and they started turning up in nicer cars and having more money and better places to live. So now I was thinking, I'm getting left behind here. I'm not earning enough to sort of keep up with these guys, with my mates, so to speak. I'm just going to have to get a real job. And as I said to you beforehand, you know, I just saw the advert in the back of the paper, sat at my mum and dad's, who said, you need to get a job, basically. And I saw this advert saying, you know, do you want a career in sport? It's in the back of the Surrey Advertiser at the time. It was a, you know, contact such and such a name in Woking. I phoned up. Said, I'm interested in the job you've got going. Said, come in for an interview. And it was at the time where jobs were quite easy to get. So I went to the interview and they said, well, this is what we do. We sell corporate hospitality at big sporting events. You'll be selling that. And I had no real idea what that meant. Didn't know. I said, okay, fine, sounds good. And it was almost like, this is the salary. It was a real low basic. It was like $7,000 a year. Wow. That was... it's a long time ago. It sounds nothing now, but it's £7,000 would pay your rent basically through the year. But obviously, you earned commission on the sales, which was quite a lot of money if you sold plenty of stuff. And so I thought that sounds all right, because I wasn't used to earning that much money anyway. I thought that's $7,000 that'll cover my rent. Blah blah blah. How much can I earn in commission? Well, it's 3% of all the sales that you make, and I was adding that up in my head. He said, so if you sold that, then you'd get paid £2,000. I went, you know, £2,000 at the time was an unbelievable amount of money for a young man. And I thought, okay, that sounds really good. So I thought, that sounds brilliant. Yes, I'm interested. And he went, well, you'd start on Monday. I literally offered the job there and then, because it was just telesales. So it was turned up on the Monday morning into this sort of pokey old office in Woking. MD, the owner, was smoking away. It was a smoking office. And I walked in the game. Oh, I don't know about this. But anyway, so I gritted and bared it. I got plonked on a desk with a phone in front of me, a Rolodex of numbers, and a big sort of folder full of sheets that had the product on. And it was just basically, I said, okay, what do I do? He said, well, there's all the numbers from the previous guys, from the guy that we've just sacked, basically, that you've come into. There's all his clients and there are his numbers that he's phoning. Just phone them and see if they want to buy that. And that was the extent of the training. What now? Yes. And it was, and the first few phone calls, I was stumbling and stuttering, you know, because we didn't have any training. And eventually a few of the guys in the office would sort of give you a few pointers, say, well, this is how you need to introduce the company. And it was kind of, it was in the deep end. There was no training. You know, these days you'd be hauled across social media for onboarding a client like that, an employee. But it was just in the deep end, sink or swim. And eventually learned through just sheer practice and numbers. It was, you know, it was hard sell. It was 150 dials a day. And it was just bang, 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 bang. Until you sold something, and then if you did sell something, you were well rewarded. So I managed okay for like 18 months, and I got this massive, massive client, a telecommunications company, and I just happened to come across them, who said, oh, just right time, right place, just sheer luck. Not because I was a good salesman, but won this massive account, which made me quite lazy as a salesperson, because I was just saying, this is brilliant, all I need to do is phone these guys up, get a sale, that's my money for the month. So I just went really, really lazy for the following 6 months, and then got sacked for being lazy. basically. So that was a wake up, because I said, hang on, I'm bringing all the money in, but the owner was said, well, I'm going to take that big client off you because that's all you're doing, and now what are you going to do? And, oh, that's not fair. Well, that's the way it is. So I got basically unceremoniously sacked, which was a wake up call. But it cut. That was a real hard sales environment and cut my teeth in it. And I just, you think fast forward now to nowadays, you think, would there be many sales environments like that? Maybe some, maybe not, but certainly it would be not commonplace now to sort of treat new salespeople like that, especially everything else is going on. I said the owner was a real, every lunchtime he'd disappear to the pub or the bar across the road, he'd come back stinking of booze at 4:30 and go, why haven't you made any sales and all this kind of stuff. Fair enough. But yeah, it cut my teeth in it and then got sacked. And then there was another job in a bigger firm in London, sales and marketing role. And I just applied for that and they liked my background and got that almost straight away as well. So I never had to struggle too much to find a job back then. But yeah, it was an eye-opener, good to say the least, in terms of what work was and what sales was. But yeah.
So there might be someone listening now who that's their first sales job out of university or something, yeah. They're selling luxury events. What have you found in terms of actually selling them that works?
I mean, I've come from two different sort of backgrounds on it, I guess, is that after I went through that, those first two companies where I was cutting my teeth, and basically you were picking up the phone to decision makers, MDs, business owners, CEOs, directors, sales directors, whatever it was, you were picking up the phone to these guys and girls and just saying, this is what we're selling. We're selling corporate hospitality at Royal Ascot. Do you entertain your clients? And it was almost as straightforward as that. It was just about being... it was just about being in as many hats as possible, and it was literally a numbers game. If you made 150 phone calls and you spoke to, over the course of a week, I don't know, 750 people, you might get 4 or 5 sales out of that, and 725 people would tell you to piss off. That would be sales, and that worked because it was just sheer numbers game. And I would still say today that I still know some of our competitors today operate in a very similar way. And it is chucking numbers at a wall, chucking as many phone calls out to decision makers as they can, pitching what they are selling, and just hoping that a percentage of those people will buy. So I do know that style still works, but it's evolved on from there into marketing has become much more important. To a decision to winning business now. The marketing needs to play a big role in sales. People need to... email marketing was probably the next sort of thing after telesales. It was a big thing in terms of that became almost the equivalent numbers game in terms of how many databases can you buy and how many hundreds of thousands of emails can you fire out to just get what you do in front of people that would just generate leads for salespeople. So that worked for a good amount of time. Then it, as everything, it just dips off a little bit. And then the new thing comes in. It becomes more sort of internet marketing, Google AdWords, getting your company up, search engines and stuff like that. And then you chuck as much money as you could at that. And how many people can we dump on our website? Again, it becomes a numbers game. And of that number of people, some will inquire, then you obviously pick up the phone to them and then sell in the normal way. And that's almost evolved forward to social media. It's been the same thing as how many people can I be in front of, which has sort of made it probably easier to be in front of more people than the previous ways, which took a lot of money. Now you just need a phone and a social media account, and you've got, if you're good at it, you've got access to millions of people. So it's kind of evolved all the way forward in terms of all of those things. And there's other forms of sales and marketing as well, but everything has evolved forwards. But I still believe almost every single method works if you're very good at it. If you're good at picking up the phone, brilliant. That's a great method of still making sales. If you're great at email marketing, it still works. If you're great at sending letters in the post, it still works. Everything still works. Just depends how good you are at it. And you just got to pick the thing that you are good at and go with that rather than, try a bit of everything. which is what people try and do. But yeah, it's interesting how it's evolved and how things work. But yeah, I think most things do.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned off air that there's a bit of a formula that your competitors use that maybe people would recognise.
So because I get quite a lot of following on LinkedIn particularly, and my posts do quite well, generally speaking. So I get a lot of people that that like my posts. So I know that we've got two or three big competitors who are very established companies in the industry, sort of 20-year-old companies, big telesales companies. They've got floors full of guys and girls who are in their sort of early 20s, again, first sales job, second sales job, basically pick up the phone, and they all have this script that is, again, phone as many decision makers as you possibly can, and hit them with this script, which is either we've just had a cancellation from a big company, an HSBC or a Barclays Bank or whoever it might be, just that sort of setting the sort of credibility tone of the conversation. We've had a table of 10 cancelled at Royal Ascot by HSBC. They paid £15,000 for it. They didn't, but you could have it for 7.5. I'll give it to you 7.5 today. And I've only got one table left. But bearing in mind, there's 120 of them in this room saying I've got one table left with the same script. And you would think, at some point, that's going to sort of run out. I know they've been using this stuff. These companies have been using this stuff for years and years and years. And it works because I know that they fill rooms and rooms, hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people at all these major events using that tactic. And it's a bit like, it's FOMO, isn't it? It's creating urgency. There's one table left. I'm getting a deal. There's credibility. You know it's been written by someone that understands psychology and sales because it kind of ticks every box that you need for someone to trust you, credibility. Oh, I need to do it. It's FOMO. I'm getting a good deal. Oh, I need to do it today. Oh, I'll miss out. So they do that a lot. They get told to pay off quite a lot, obviously. But ultimately, someone buys it and they supply it. It's a good event. That customer's happy, and they get a repeat client from the back of it.
It feels the way you're describing it. I was telling you off air that I had a very similar conversation, and I was actually like, from someone that makes cold calls and gets cold calls, I was actually like, surprised that I was like, bloody hell, someone's just shouting at me for three minutes. So it feels like your approach is you've seen the corporate underworld, you know what they do, you know every kind of trick of the trade, and you've said, right, if they're all zigging, I'm going to zag and do it a completely different way. I guess what was the thinking behind that? What have been some of the success stories? And I'm sure you've come into hot water at times as well.
Yeah. So when we started Barclay Red. This is after I left my previous agency, which was built corporately, normal sales team, normal marketing activities, marketing budget, marketing manager, da da da. So it was a very sort of established agency, and we had a very normal, in inverted commas, way of finding business and getting business. So that run its course. It was still, amicable. Leave, so to speak, and I was still a shareholder there when I left. So it was all very. It just run its course for me personally because I just felt the joy had gone out of it a little bit, and became so big, not so big, but big enough for it to become very, very corporately run on a spreadsheet, so to speak, as opposed to the creativity and all that kind of stuff which I enjoyed. So anyway. We started Barclay Red up with one of my best mates from university who's in recruitment. And it was almost like on a whim, say, okay, well, we'll just start it up and see what happens. And it went 6 months and getting a little tiny bit of business here and there from people that kind of knew me and previous clients that knew I was back in the game, that sort of thing. But it wasn't enough to bang it forwards. And I thought, we had minimal money, and we had a little bit of investment money put into the company to cover a little bit of sort of salary here and there, but we didn't have loads of money in the company. And I said to Kristen, we need to do something different here because we're not going to compete with the company that's got 80 telesales people in the room making thousands of phone calls every week. Can't compete with that because we haven't got the sales team. we can't compete with the other big agencies and the other big competitors because they've got hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of marketing spend, and they've got a better website than us, and they can advertise more, and they've got better marketing, and da 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 da. And they're just going to, whatever we do with our minimal amount of money, it's just not, it's, we're going to lose. Eventually, we're going to lose against the big boys. If we try and do everything the same, and we are, because that works for them, it's going to work for us. No, no, it works for them because they chuck loads of money at it and they make it work through sort of volume. So this is just not, we're just not going to go anywhere. We're just going to eventually just peter. We might survive for a couple of years and then we're just going to peter out. So we took two different angles on what we were going to do. One was more of a product risk thing, which is a slightly different area. But the main thing we did, I said, is look, we need to run our marketing in a completely different way. And I was a big fan at the time of Paddy Power. You know, don't know if you've seen their Twitter feed and what they do for their marketing. It's very left field, very funny, irreverent, offensive at times. I said, why don't we run our Twitter feed like Paddy Power? And we just tell jokes and we do funny stuff. But then I thought, I don't really know Twitter that well. I just don't know who's on it. It had a bit of a reputation of being a bit of a cesspit at the time. Don't know if I could find clients on there. And I thought, hang on, that I was always on LinkedIn from the previous agency, but we'd only just used it corporately, as in you'd go onto the search bar and go managing directors, finance London, and get a big old list, and then go sales lads, there's a list of 300 MDs, contact them. We didn't use it in a marketing or content marketing place. But then around about sort of 2018, 2019, I sort of went on there, and there was starting to be these guys like, and you'll know them, people like Mike Winnett and Dan Kelsall and these sorts of guys that were just producing this content that was just basically funny content. And I was looking at the engagement they were getting on the back of it. And look, these guys are quite funny. They're not hilarious. They're not like fall off your seat. They're just funny. They're just funny guys, and they write good content. But it was so different from what LinkedIn was that people were going, oh, that's different. That's not dry. It's not corporate. And it still had a sales message in there as well. So I just thought, I can do that. I can do that for our business because I've got a bit of creativity. I know I've got a good sense of humor. I can start doing this left field stuff on LinkedIn and relate it to what we do and start building up our following that way. And we don't need money to compete because the competitor can't compete with me because they're not me. So I sort of built up this persona, if you like, and I tried lots of different things. I did a lot of video stuff, like left field video, and that sort of, it heightened during COVID as well because everyone was sat at home in their garden. Nothing to do. Social media was there. Probably LinkedIn was the only way people were keeping in contact with each other. And through that period, I sort of grew, as they say, quite considerably just by using this left field style of funny content that was, again, it pushed the boundaries a little bit at times. We certainly lost opportunities of clients in the back of it because it's like, I'm not dealing with these jokers or that clown. He's not serious, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, it definitely got us a lot of interest from lots of proper business owners and MDs who just like that style and I'm fed up with this boring, dull, corporate style of content that I'm saying. I really like what you do. And underneath it, I would always have this sort of serious, there would be a serious post every so often to go, this is, by the way, this is what we're doing. I'm not just joking around. If I sort of married the two together quite well. So yeah, that was a kind of zig and the zag moment, and none of our competitors were doing it because they're all, if you looked at all the sales guys and the senior people in our competitors, all their posts are very, very cool for school. So I'm look at me, this is where I am and da 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 da, here's my glass of champagne and let me know if you want to join me. It was just really sort of braggy type of stuff, and I just went the opposite way on it, and sort of downplayed my success and made myself out to be the worst boss in the world and had literally was starving hungry and had to sell my children. And this sort of really sort of went completely opposite from the too cool for school. And it was all tongue in cheek, obviously, but it poked fun at the sort of the style of content that is a little bit look how successful I am and look how much money I have and here's my lovely car and here's my big house. And I was poking fun at that style of it because I was the sort of business we were doing, we were dealing with people that were genuinely successful, who were millionaires and who were genuinely successful because they couldn't afford it to go on a super yacht in Monaco otherwise. And these guys, you just realize they're just normal guys. No, none of them were shouting about their wealth and success on social media, but you had all these sort of wannabes around saying, look how successful I am. So it was poking a little bit of fun at that as well, which sort of resonated with people. And then more and more people cottoned onto that style of content as well. So then it's become very popular now, as you know, that style of sort of satire and
taking the piss,
basically. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a, as we all know, LinkedIn is full of very wanky content.
It is.
So the thing with what you sell, I've always been interested in this, and we were talking not too long ago, but actually there's sales, like you say, you ended up in a telesales role. Thanks to TikTok and Instagram now and YouTube and all those things, a lot of young people are being fascinated with sales and being like, how can I be a remote closer and live in Bali? Or how do I be a high ticket salesperson? So I think there probably is a difference when you're selling like courses for £100 and then if you're selling kind of boat trips for thousands of pounds to millionaires. What have you found about, what kind of lessons have you learned along the way? Because obviously they are still normal people and I think people get that. But what lessons have you learned when it comes to selling high ticket products to millionaires?
Number one, they're normal people. As you said, I can't reiterate that enough. I think there's a lot of, how do I talk to these people? Do I need to come across ultra professional or do I need to sort of come across in a certain way? You don't. You're just normal. They're just normal because most of them have come from where you are now, ultimately. A lot of guys and girls that we come across that are very successful, once upon a time, they were starting their own company up. Or they were very junior. They know the journey. And generally speaking, they're quite supportive. If you're very honest with them, say, we're just starting out. This is our new agency. This is what we're trying to do. And they as long as you're very honest and yourself, that's number one. But I'd say the second thing is don't be afraid to talk to them. And I think there's a lot of trepidation now in terms of picking up the phone. I think people will find every other method to speak to somebody or to communicate rather than pick up the phone. If you've got a phone number there on the bottom of an email or on an inquiry in or whatever it is, what I found is, especially in the younger sales group, and this is going back, is that they'll ping an email, they'll see the number, but they'll ping an email and then they'll find their profile on social media and they'll try and ping a message that way. And it will just be, well, why don't you just pick up, send a text message. It's pick up the phone. And okay, if you don't get through, you don't get through. But if you do, that's when you've got most chance to sell. So I'd say don't be afraid to pick up the phone to these guys. And then thirdly, you've got to know your product inside out. You've got to know it. You can't BS them. And part of that is, I think a lot of people get obsessed with the sort of the method of sales sometimes, as opposed to know your product. You've got to know your product. If you know your product better than the equivalent salesperson in the competitor, and you can talk about it a bit better, and you can you understand it a little bit better, you understand why the client might want to do it, etc. You can understand all of that side of things. You've got a much better opportunity to sell rather than just try all these different methods apart from talk to them, or then trying to bullshit a little bit about what you're trying to sell. And ultimately, it does come down a little. I still believe that even through all this, you can be as targeted as you like. It does come down a little bit still to numbers. You know, you've still got to talk to a number of people because you're still going to get 80-90% no's. Whatever you do, you're still going to get that many of people saying it's not for me at the time, or I can't make it. Any because of the style of the stuff that we're selling, it's not business critical. A lot of it, it's sort of. Some of it's nice to have. Some of it is, I'll do it if I have the chance or if I've got time to do it, that sort of thing. So we get a lot of it's not, as I said, it's not a business critical decision for a lot of people. So you are you get a lot of reasons why people can't do something. So the number of people that become no's are quite high in reality. So you still need that numbers. So lead generation is quite important as well. It's just to make sure your pipeline's full. If you've only got 10 opportunities in your pipeline, you're only selling one or two of them, then you're wondering why you're in target or why you're not selling as much as you can. Well, you can route it back to how many opportunities you've got in your pipeline. So I'd say those sort of few things are quite key, and that's something that I bang on with our guys about, is make sure your pipelines are full. Because without opportunities, you can't sell. Simple as that. And it's just, I think, again, you know, I know you guys are in it, but I think there's so much sales guru stuff on the internet and advice about this, that, or the next thing. And some of it is just very cloudy and makes it complicated. I think sales is quite simple, actually, at its heart. It's just not many people have the bravery, in inverted commas, to get on the phone and talk to people, and the sort of thick skin to cope with regular rejection and people saying no and having a bad month. You know, the best salespeople just keep going and keep going and keep going. And eventually you'll get your rewards. And it's just how long can you outstay your competition as well. So there's a few things, probably pitching to the converted a little bit there. But as I said, I try and keep sales as a process as simple as we possibly can, and simplify it for people, because I just think there's so many methods and stuff like that float around, and theories that you can just get, you can't see the wood for the trees sometimes.
I think that's really good advice. There's a lot of people who overcomplicate it,
yeah,
and alarm bells should go up, because there's probably a course attached to the complicated method. Yeah. I'm interested to know how much do you think status is the driving decision behind wanting to be on that yacht in Monaco?
You'll have to ask the people that book it, if I'm honest. I am absolutely sure that it plays a role for some. And it's, look at, yeah, it's almost like, this is what I want to tell my neighbours when I go home. Mm-hmm. I want to tell my friends and family, this is what I've done. I'm sure there's an element of that. A lot of it is, I'm doing something that most others can't afford to do. There's that side of things, as well as a little bit of exclusivity. And it's probably the same with all luxury brands. You know, ultimately, you know, you go back to clothing and things like that. You know, if you're wearing a designer brand, is it any better quality than, you know, the T-shirt you buy down Marks and Spencer's or Next or whatever it is with no brand on it? No, not really. It's the same stuff, but you'll pay another 100 quid because of a little horse there, or whatever it is. So there's status buying all over the shop in all luxury goods, and it's Rolex watches, whatever it might be. So that certainly bleeds into what we sell, especially to individuals. But we have this sort of slightly unique sort of service and product where we are selling, half of it is selling to individuals like the B2C market, and half is selling to the B2B market. And they're using it for different things. So the B2B might be saying to their clients, oh, come along on a yacht, or come along to this lovely event in this beautiful facility. And it's kind of the status of the invite. Oh, yeah, that's very nice. And it's like, you've interviewed Rory Sutherland, haven't you? And I think he it's like, why is champagne so expensive? It's not that it tastes any better than Prosecco or sparkling wine. It's what the expensiveness is what it represents to who you're giving it to. It's like, I've spent this money on you because you're important to me. So that bleeds into a little bit of the quality of the invite a company might send to its clients. Go, come to Monaco with us. And the client goes, well, you obviously think a lot of me and a lot of my business to spend that on me. So there's a little bit of that type of status that goes on. And then the B2C thing, there's a mix between, I want to show off to my mates, and I just like doing really nice stuff because I've earned some decent money, and this stuff is really nice and fun to do. So it can, as I don't want to overcomplicate it. Sometimes it just comes down to, I like having fun, and that's it. And it's like VIP fun. It's like Monaco. We always say Monaco is like Disneyland for children, for adults rather. And that's what it is. It's just people that have worked hard for a living having fun. And just enjoying the best of life, so to speak. So, and long may that continue, because it's not, people get a little bit annoyed about the sort of, almost sometimes what the industry represents, which is like the very top end, the 1%, and oh, it's all right for them. But that, that money that they spend bleeds down, and it feeds my kids, puts a roof over my head, employs my salespeople, employs millions or hundreds of thousands of people in the country in the events industry and events space. So that money all bleeds down and supports a massive, massive industry, which is the way I sort of look at it. So, because sometimes you do get a little bit, you know, is it morally right for someone to spend £100,000 for four people to go to the Monaco Grand Prix on the private jet? And that's coming to your question earlier, is when I put this stuff on out there on LinkedIn, going, guess how much this stuff costs? Guess how much our top end Monaco, like private jet, super yacht, five-star hotel, helicopters, all the rest of it. And it might be that it's some ridiculous figure, like $100,000 for four people or something like that. And you'll get a lot of comments saying that's disgraceful. Saying how can you live with yourself when there's people starving and all that kind of stuff. So it's quite an interesting industry to grapple with morally and ethically. But as I said, that money is not just disappearing. It's not a millionaire giving money to millionaires. It's supporting a whole ecosystem beneath it of normal people.
How does that sit with you then? The ethical, moral.
I'm fine with it, because like I said, I've been in it a long time, and as I said, I've just seen it support a lot of normal people, and a lot of normal people get mortgages, put their kids through school, raise kids, put food on the table, whatever it is, to live normal lives on the back of being in that events industry space, which is financed either by big business or by wealthy people. So it's the same with any luxury. I mean, is it ethically, morally right to spend £10,000 on a watch? Probably not. But that supports an industry below it. So that's the way I look at it. We're not so different from, say, a top end car or a piece of jewelry or a branded clothing or stuff like that.
Nice. And then you've been doing this for many years. So I guess if you could look back on the time that you've been doing it, there's probably been some big lessons. We've been in business 4 years now, and God, I wish I could go back to Jack 4 years ago and say, be prepared for this, do this. What have been some of the hardest kind of waves to reckon with that throughout your entrepreneurial journey?
I've been relatively lucky in that my previous agency, one of the guys that was one of the directors there, I wouldn't say who it is, but had a big background in business. He was a sort of an MD CEO of major household names, and had a real good grasp of business, and he would come in as our sort of chairman, so to speak, every so often, and keep us on the straight and narrow a little bit in terms of business. So I learned quite good business as lessons quite early in my sort of career as an I was a shareholder of the company, but I was an employee of it as well. And we were a startup company, but those sort of, as we grew, you need to do different things at different stages as your business grows. And this chap had been through all of it from startup to, as I said, you know, multinational PLC, billion-pound companies. And so the lesson, you know, all the knowledge and advice and experience that he had, he sort of bled into us as a company. So we never sort of went off the, you know, we had tough years, you know, 2008 credit crash and all the rest of it, and that was tough to get through, and sometimes you have better years than not. And I think that's just business in a way. So I'd learned a lot of sort of lessons through working with someone and having access to someone that had been there and done it, which again, is a sort of talking sideways. I think a lot of people get wrong now. There's a lot of chat about, oh, go and leave your job and start your own business as a 23-year-old and go for it. Guarantee you most of these are going to be out of business in 2 years' time because they don't know what they're doing. And the best way, you know, it's not a course or anything else. It's go work with a startup, go and get employed by a smallish company and go and work with the founders or the directors. And you will learn so much more through doing 2 or 3 years of that. You can see what they're doing. You can, if they make a mistake, you say, I'm not going to make that one myself, and go into starting your own business with a bit of experience. And then you've got far better chance of it succeeding. But in terms of the sort of major stuff I picked up really is, and we did make this mistake, is that in my previous agency, is that don't spread yourself too thin in terms of what you, product and marketing and whatever you're doing. If you've got some resource, spend it almost in like a concentrated area, or don't try and sell too many products at once. Become known for one product. Like Bartley Red, we said, you know what, we're going to hang our hat on the Monaco Grand Prix on a super yacht. And that is all we sold really for 2 years. And that was all our marketing was. It was bang, 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 bang. And we did a lot of content rather than what we could have done, you know, in our previous agency was trying to sell like 50 things and like spreading the marketing over those 50 things. So you didn't really find that magical sort of moment of marketing where you've done something different and it massively works for you because you haven't given it a chance. So that's what we felt coming back was just like, we're going to concentrate on one product. We're going to become really well known for that in that space. And we're going to concentrate all of our marketing on it. And I tried lots of different things. And like I said, it took like 9 months to come up with the style of LinkedIn marketing, which was like the magic moment. I didn't know it was going to work. It was just a risk. You know, this could blow backwards on us because everyone might hate this and we're going to get no inquiries because they think we're jokers. So it was a massive risk. But we tried it because that we were willing to sort of try these things. So I think allied to sort of being very honed in on one product, and if you've got marketing channels, try and master one or two of them rather than all the social media channels and all of this. Or if you're very good at telesales, be good at telesales, and that's the way you should spend 90% of your time, and then maybe 10% trying other things. So sort of within that, you might try to tell you what, within my telesales, I'm going to try this ridiculous script. I'm going to have a mental opener. I'm just going to try it. But you might find that it bombs. You might find that it amazingly works. But you got to have the bravery to try that stuff. Mm. So that's what I'd say. You know, just take learn how to take risks as well. That's something that I'm quite good at now. Is juggling that risk with risk reward without betting the crown jewels on it. No one really knows what's going to work and what isn't going to work. Marketing is very we'll test it and see, but you got to have the bravery and risk-taking attitude to try it.
Yeah, when you were talking there, I was thinking about people listening to this, and I was like, there's a curiosity there, because obviously and you spoke about Mike Winnett earlier, and I always see him commenting on posts saying like, yeah, your vanity metrics are nice, but they're not going to pay the bills. So because you've done well from a marketing standpoint, what's the actual like return on that? Like, what do you see in terms of like, or what's the feedback you get from people? What are the numbers? What's all like the bit behind the numbers, I guess?
Well, number one, we haven't spent a penny on marketing. When I say a penny, we pay a nominal amount of an email marketing platform. You know, it might be like £100 a month or something like that. We've not spent any big money on marketing our company necessarily, other than my time. And I think there is a cost to that, in terms of I've spent an inordinate amount of time on LinkedIn. I must have written 5,000 posts or something like that over the time, and I probably spent half my day on there every day, but going back years. So, you know, I spend a lot of time on the platform because I know it works in terms of generating inquiries. So in terms of, you know, we're a what did we do in the last 12 months? So we've done like £2 million worth of sales in the last 12 months, something like that. I'd say 75% of that is due to leads that have come from LinkedIn that I've either generated or that became a client 5 years ago and they're a repeat business, blah, blah, blah. But you can almost link most things back to they found us through LinkedIn. So the ROI is... The numbers are difficult to say because there's lifetime value on for us. Again, we've got the type of business that if we get a client in, they're likely to be a repeat client for as long as we can keep them happy. So the lifetime value of someone could be 20 years. So it just costs me a bit of time to get that initial inquiry in. Then the ROI is through the roof. And if we look at it over the course of, say, 10, 20 years, in terms of what you want to build your company. Again, there's a lot of short-termism in marketing. Why hasn't that campaign worked? Why we spent £10,000 on that and we've only got £12,000 back for it? Well, okay, well, those clients that spent 12 grand with you, they're going to spend 12 next year and maybe 15 the year after and da-da-da-da-da. So it becomes a lifetime value of stuff that you've got to understand with marketing. It's not just what you get immediately in those 12 months. But I would guess that in terms of numbers of leads and things like that we get, I mean, and it's dipped a little bit recently because the algorithms have become a little bit naughty. But at its peak, I was probably getting anywhere between 50 and 100 leads a month for sort of high-end stuff. And some of the quality would be all over the place. But you would find clients within that. And that's largely how we've built our business and our brand. Punched above our weight in many respects as well, and said not spent a penny on marketing really, and that helps the profitability of the companies that we can spend that money on a salesperson or doing something else. Now we've got to the stage now as a company where we need to start spending more money on marketing because we want to go to the next level. And LinkedIn can only sustain so much of that, but we've got ourselves to the stage where we're all right with money in the bank, we've got investors in, and we know what we're doing, so to speak. We've got repeat clients, so we know we can invest money going forwards. But I don't see that as that's got to pay off in the next 12 months. That's, again, a lifetime value thing on a client. So that's the way I'd look at the numbers a little bit.
So it sounds like the formula is quite predictable. You're in a lucky spot where you've done this before. You've figured out what works and what doesn't. If the business disappeared overnight, and you had to start it again tomorrow, is there anything you would do differently?
We started the business as a remote business, as in everybody could work from where they wanted to. We've moved it a little bit further into more of a hybrid model now, where once a week, the sales guys will come into an office and work together. Now, we've found over the course of the years that we've gone through quite a lot of salespeople. Not through our bad management, as the internet would say, but working from home is extraordinarily difficult for a salesperson. Mm. And you've got to find the right type of person that can do it. Because if you're sat alone, a lot of salespeople will feed off the energy and people around them. Because if four of you or five of you are making phone calls, then it feels nice and easy for you to make one. Whereas if you're sat alone at home and it's dead silent, the motivation to make that call, to pick up the phone or to work quickly, you need to be a certain type of person. So it took a while to sort of almost learn that, because this working from home thing is a relatively new concept. And we brought it in before COVID. We were doing it before it was all trendy to do it. So we've had quite a lot of experience of managing people working from home. And if we were to do something different, it would be to be more office-based earlier. And perhaps move it to more of a 2 or 3 day office rather than as we have now 1 day. But that's because one of our guys lives in Liverpool, one lives in Birmingham, and it's difficult to almost row back the clock a little bit. So that would be the big thing I would change. I would still do the same type of marketing, because LinkedIn would still be a massive opportunity, and I just see it as free marketing. If you're good at content, it's free. And it's just about understanding, you know, I still find it bizarre that, you know, I think I've got like 52,000 followers or something like that. It's like a football stadium. I can walk out in front of a football stadium every single day and say, buy my stuff, or this is what we do. And I know it doesn't exactly work like that, but you know what I mean? It's like you have, if you can build that audience up to a significant level, even if you're talking to like 2,000 or 3,000, that's still like a massive theatre. How much will people pay to come and to be on a stage in front of 3,000 potential buyers? You'd probably pay quite a lot of money for that, but that's what I think people just can't get there. A lot of people that don't grasp the opportunity that's there in terms, but you need to do it very regularly. It doesn't happen overnight. You need to be very, very militant. You need to have lots of content going out every day. You need to be quite good at it as well. It needs to be good content. Can't just be any old rubbish. So that's
he's done you there.
Yours was quite good, Jack. But you know, it needs to cut through the noise a little bit. You need to have a different tone of voice. You need to say something that's a bit different. You need to be a little bit polarizing. Be prepared to take a risk. Be prepared for people not to like you. Take the abuse when it comes and just laugh along with it. But for me, that's how business has massively changed. It's almost like democratized it with big. You know, I could have as much reach as our competitors now in terms of marketing, and they're kind of catching up a little bit. Going, oh bloody hell! But you know, we've got to step on them in terms of our social media side of things, which massively helps. And just said, it just helps us not to spend as much as we would have had to on other forms of marketing.
Nice. I think, unfortunately, we're probably out of time. There's probably a part two in this somewhere. I think there's probably plenty more we could have talked about.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, you've got 52,000 LinkedIn followers already, but if people want to be...
Yeah, that's a place to find me. I would say that's where I am mostly. So, yeah, LinkedIn, come and say hello and drop me a message or whatever. But, yeah, follow along if you want to see what the type of content I do. So, yeah.
Nice.
Beautiful. Right. Thank you, James.
Thanks, guys.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right.